Good morning. Welcome to the Faith Debate on News Radio 930 WFMD. I'm your host and the pastor of Household of Faith in Christ, online at householdoffaithinchrist.com. We're joined this week, of course, by Daniel. I say, of course, because he's here pretty much every week. Daniel Rasvi. He's with one of the pastors at the church that meets at Imran's house, and they've got a organization called Conquered by Love Ministries, and they're online at conqueredbylove.org. And David Forsey, he's a pastor in the area, and they kind of hopscotch around the counties around this area to see where they're going to meet from week to week. And so if you ever want to catch up with him, he might be meeting at next door neighbor's house. You don't even know it yet. So if you'd like to find out, reach out to me. I'll put you in touch with David. You can crash his party one of these Sunday mornings. And we're also joined, of course, if you've been listening the last couple of weeks, you know it's, of course, Dan Cox. I'm going to do it this time. You can find out about Dan Cox and his run for U.S. Congress at coxforcongress.org. That's his last name, Cox, and then the word for, as opposed to the number four, congress.org. And you can find out all about what he's trying to accomplish in his run. Even though he's not a politician, he's running for office, because he doesn't like being called a politician. So we're not going to call him that anymore. And I'm going to see if my research is okay on some of this. Let's see. Undergrad from Maryland, University of Maryland, is that right? You got your undergrad from Maryland? Law degree from Regent University?
Yes.
Okay. So really liberal school, really conservative school, back to back there. attained rank of captain in the U.S. Civil Air Patrol.
Yes. Supporting my children who were using that great organization to get training and get opportunities such as flight lessons and things.
So do you fly?
I do not. My brother is a pilot, but not me.
So you're a captain, but you can't fly?
No. No, we did a lot of groundwork. You know, they train, so the Civil Air Patrol trains both for flights over the bay to watch out for potential terrorist or drug activity. And they also, though, have ground recovery teams. They train the kids how to go to a crash site or to a disaster site to help out. Obviously not frontline stuff because they're kids, but certainly great training. They teach them everything that you would want to have your kid know, just like Boy Scouts. And then they actually do deploy and help out with things like water distribution and other non-seriously dangerous activities. So I did more of the ground work for that, but
cool. And local boy, grew up around here. I think Tawnytown is officially what your hometown was growing up, correct?
That's right. Frederick County side, believe it or not. And now we live in northwestern Frederick County. So grew up on a farm. I was honored and blessed to get out of the city. And as much as we love the city, I had a dream to be out in the wide open spaces. And so part of the vision that my parents had in launching their statewide home education program was to actually do a microcosm of training for the family. So our education became home-based, and I became a small businessman at age 14 when I had my first sheep flock and developed that, and learned at age 16 that in order to sell lamb, I had to compete internationally with the Australians. Believe it or not. And so I had to compete, learn to run my business, making sure that I could beat their dollar per pound price. So that was very, very good for me as a 4-H'er, as a farm boy, and learn a lot of hard work. And that kind of, I think, created a lot of groundwork for me to be able to do the calling God had for me and to go to law school.
So your parents were very involved in the home education movement.
They were.
Maryland in particular.
Yes. Still are, yes, sir.
So were you home educated? You were the oldest,
yes,
of their children. Were you home educated for all of your years?
Most. So okay. I was a student at the Frederick Christian Academy until my father launched the first homeschool program in Maryland, which was a statewide educational administration. And in that process, that was 1983. In that process, he worked with the state of Maryland to create the regulatory permissive sphere so that the attacks that some were making would go away, to say, no, this is an academic program, and it's been very successful. I ended up graduating, went on to college, and I came back and worked for my dad for about 10 years in that administrative school administration as the registrar, and we helped over 1,000 young people graduate high school, and 95% were able, as we know, homeschoolers are very smart, 95% either were accepted to college and went on to college, or went to trade school, or got another kind of certification, became successful. So very few graduates from homeschooling didn't have opportunities. So that was my, my dad was a pioneer in that. Still is. He's still at it. So I'm very proud of
him. And you were a teacher, too, weren't you, at a high school?
Yes. With the home education program, we had AP-level courses. So I taught church history, American government, and the Constitution. And I, as part of that, for the 10 years, I would lead tours of my students. If they would make their grades, then I gave them a promise I would lead the three articles tour. And, you know, most people, when you ask them, what are the three articles, they can't name it.
Was that purposely playing off of Gilligan's Island?
No, actually.
Oh, three articles tour.
No, I'm not even a fan of that show. But no.
What? Who doesn't like Gilligan?
I'm sorry, yeah.
Come on.
Full disclosure. When you read the Constitution, when you ask anyone on the street about the Constitution, you ask them to name Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, they can't do it. Most of us could not. So my remedy in teaching it for high schoolers was I wanted them to see it, because one of the ways that I learned very, very well was not only by reading and absorbing and memorizing, but of going and doing and hands-on. And so I wanted them to see Article 1, and they would see Congress. I wanted them to see Article 2, and we toured the White House. And I wanted them to see Article 3, and went into the chambers of the Supreme Court. And they got to see those three branches of government, how the federal system is supposed to work. And then obviously we would go down as well to Annapolis. And as a state delegate, I continued tours for my constituents of the state house, so that a lot of kids don't understand, you know, their learning process is growing to learn, and a lot of adults don't know this, that we have a federal system of government where you have the three branches in the state and you have the three branches in the United States. And so, and watching how and studying how that interplays under Article 5 of the Constitution as well, and the Bill of Rights.
Have you ever crossed paths with David Barton?
I have not.
Oh,
no.
Okay. Because he does tours and stuff. I didn't know if...
I have never crossed. Well, my tour was not really a tour per se. It was a teacher-led educational day.
Right. By the way, I shouldn't just name drop David Barton. I think he's a historian. People think he's a quasi-historian. He's very controversial. He's very conservative. He's got a number of DVDs and streaming things you can watch about American history. He had a Founders Bible that they published, his organization published, and he does tours throughout D.C., mostly, I think, with pastors and stuff, if I'm not mistaken. And so I was just curious if
I would love to go to Texas and see his collection. My understanding is he has one of the best historical American document collections.
Yeah, I think that's what really endeared him to Glenn Beck. Beck's a huge fan of his. He's been a guest on Glenn's show, and I think that was the hook. Hey, Glenn, you want to come see some of my cool stuff? So I think that was his in with Glenn. But anyway, you had that question that was kind of a dangling participle from last week. You want to bring it back up again?
So speaking of being in Annapolis, and you spent a bunch of time in Annapolis, you were a delegate there for several years. And I think we had a conversation once, something to the effect that, you know, it's really difficult the way that – it's one thing the way you want politics to work. You know, you wish – we could say, hey, you know, I want to have a bill that you know, bans killing puppies or whatever it is. And they're like, okay, you know, I second the motion. All right, the bill passed. And that was like one line, don't kill puppies, right? And that would be wonderful if bills got passed that way. But they don't, because I'm not going to vote for your bill unless you vote for my thing, which you hate. And so we end up with this omnibus package that's 3,000 pages long that has a lot of garbage in there. So no matter who votes for it, you can be sure that somebody's going to go and do a smear campaign. See, he voted for this. But if you don't want to participate in that, then nobody really wants to work with you or help you get anything done. So how are you able to get anything done in that kind of system without compromising your principles and saying, look, I will not vote for killing babies. I will not vote for, you know, transgender, garbage stuff, which are things that I believe your campaign has said something to that effect. So how do you deal with that?
Well, you pass puppy bills because they pass unanimously. Seriously, In my committee, the Republicans learned to pass bills that everybody appreciated, and one of them almost every year there's a dog bill of some kind, and they tend to pass unanimously without a lot of back and forth because people like dogs and animals, and it's fuzzy, and everybody's happy and nobody fights.
That's funny. But I made up a fake law as an example, but that's the way.
Well, why can PSD... Why do PSD folks have the right to take their dogs in court now? That came through my committee. It was unanimous. You can take your dog into court if you have PTSD, if you have a need for a dog. Anyway, what your question is excellent, and it is a problem in politics, and that is twofold. It's always been there, but it's sometimes gotten worse lately, I think, with the incredible, intense hatred on the left towards the conservatives on the right. What has happened in the last, I would suggest maybe the last 10 years especially, is we've had a lot of the Republican base awakening to the fact that they've been voting for leadership that has lied to them in many respects and has led them potentially astray in some respects. And so they've become much more aware. I think social media has a lot to do with this as well. They become much more aware of the issues in politics, instantly finding out what the votes are. For instance, within a second of when those votes would post on the board in Annapolis, somebody would snap a picture and it would be on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, and 1,000 constituents would be texting that delegate saying, "How dare you switch your vote, quick." That's the big change. And the intensity.
You can switch it after you cast it?
During a certain period of time, yes. You have to, if the speaker calls the question, then you have to do it in writing and you have to have a reason. There's rules and you have to do it within.
Sorry.
There's a whole process on the rules. But the point is, what you're saying is, what about the big votes and the intensity of the push for compromise with the party politics? And yeah, it's there. I mean, I have experienced it. The way that I've sought to deal with it as somebody who felt called to lead in the political circle is you do a lot of backroom discussions. So for instance, we would have legislation that the caucus would put forth and say, we want everybody to unanimously support this. And as somebody who was a chair of one of the committees, I was the chair of the Second Amendment Committee for the caucus, which meant that they were looking to me to vet a lot of bills to make sure they didn't accidentally vote for a bad bill. So I had a lot, every time you're in charge of one of these areas of policy, we look to each other. And so you have to trust the committee process also, because your ranking members on the committees are supposed to tell the rest of the caucus about bad bills. However, occasionally a bad bill would get voted out of committee with the Republican support, and it would be flagged by one of us in the back room where we would have our caucus meetings. When I say back room, it's a public. I mean, it's there. We have our caucus meetings, sometimes public, sometimes closed. But it's
cigars.
It's a no. Well, no. Off campus. But I would, occasionally myself and some others would occasionally flag some bills, and I'll never forget on my first, I think my first week or two in office. It was going to be a unanimous vote. The committee had supported it. The Republicans on the committee supported the bill. And it was going to be something that everybody was going to vote for. And if I recall, it might have even been, I don't want to get anybody in trouble, so I don't want to say the issue. But at the end of the day, I looked at it and I thought, this violates a constitutional principle of due process. You can't be held guilty for something without an adjudication of guilt or a finding of guilt. And what they were doing was, on that particular bill, was charging people up front for fees and costs before there was any adjudication of any wrongdoing in both a civil and a potentially criminal atmosphere. So it was geared as a civil issue, but all civil charges can turn into potential criminal charges, which totally ruins your due process if you just were dragged into the mud and you had to admit things or do things that may have compromised you. But anyway, as Republicans who are law enforcement supporters, we believe in the Constitution. And a lot of times Republicans don't necessarily see the Constitution as supreme. They don't get it sometimes because they're either not trained for it, or it's too easy just to go along with what they're afraid of having something happen that would expose an embarrassment to make them look like they're supporting the bad guy. And so they're willing to vote for bad legislation just so that it doesn't look. And this is not just Republicans. It's across the board. Any politician has this problem. Any elected official. I like the term elected officials. They're all people like us.
Troy, take a note. Elected official.
They're all people like us. And they simply, I mean, just like in your business or in your church, somebody challenges you on something and you don't want to, you want to make sure your judgment is not mistaken and misunderstood by others. And so you have to kind of weigh how that is viewed in the perception as well as what's actually being done. And I flagged it. I was like, is anybody here? I think the call came out. Is anybody? It's going to be unanimous, right? Let's report this unanimously. And I had to raise my hand in front of 42 delegates and say, no, I'm not signing on that bill because it violates the Constitution. And, of course, it was like, what? Oh, no. Is this going to make us all look bad? Because if you take a position in opposition to your caucus, you have to be sensitive to the fact that your friends might look bad to their constituents because why did Dan Cox vote this way and now that makes them look bad? And that's not my intent. That's not any Republican's intent. And that's the beauty of our party, by the way. The Republicans believe in freedom of conscience on votes. We don't hold it to each other's account. Democrats, man, if you don't vote the way you're told as a Democrat, I've watched it happen, you will lose committee assignments. Boom, you're out. They will take you off a committee. So long story short, in that context, I've had the necessity of having to stand up and say no for the budget. For instance, you can look in the Frederick newspaper. The Republican caucus supported Larry Hogan's budget. I did not. And there were about 20 of us Republicans out of the 42 who did not. And it created a little bit of controversy in the caucus. Like, how dare you? This is a Republican governor. How could you not support his budget? And I was like, look, I think a lot of it, he's trying to do what's right. There's some good stuff in there. There's boost money for the kids that get them out of the public schools and give them opportunities because these schools are killing them. And there's this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, it's full of pork. It's not constitutional because it's full of pork. It's lining the coffers of groups that should not be receiving it, such as Casa de Maryland, which is a communist organization, and we're funding it. And all these other aspects that, for instance, I found $1.2 billion in the budget going to serve sanctuary state status in Maryland. Over $1.2 billion going directly to fund EBT cards and other benefits for those here illegally, which in six jurisdictions can vote. Illegal aliens can vote in Maryland. Now, I'm a very compassionate person when it comes to immigrants. My brother-in-law is from Mexico City. He's here legally. He's got his green card. He's got his citizenship. My nephew's wife is, I helped her get her green card legally. She's here legally from the Ukraine. Her family is a Christian outreach. Her father's a pastor there. They're doing house church outreach in Ukraine in the midst of war. But some of them had to escape. And, you know, I get it. This is the land of opportunity, but you better do it right under law or else we don't have a country. And I'm tired of this whole mantra of Christianity saying that, well, we have to have compassion, love one another.
But Jesus was all about love.
We have to open our borders. There's even a song. I got so disgusted. There's a song on the Christian radio that came on that said, open borders. I couldn't believe it. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And that's not love. Love is when you uphold justice and law for people because then they have a sense of security and understanding that they're not going to have their stuff, you know, robbed, raped, and destroyed.
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. You mentioned the Christian radio station in name only, probably. Most of the Christian stations, the stuff that would pass as Christian worldview, it's very secular. And and then you mentioned the Republican governor in name only, probably. But anyway, I got to say, and I don't know if you guys would agree, I'm listening to that litany of how, you know, how the sausage gets made. And I felt like I was just emotionally put through the meat grinder. It's so discouraging. Mm. I mean, you got people in the caucus that are worried about, like, their friends walking through the halls of Congress or in the delegates or whatever, more than they're worried about their constituents who are back home. So we've got this huge country with over 300 million people in it, represented by, you know, hundreds of people. And yet those hundreds of people are running an albatross that's tens of hundreds of millions of people probably working for the federal government system in various ways. So we're not really a nation of that's constitutional anymore because these things that are unconstitutional get passed.
Right.
Well, how does it get passed if it's unconstitutional? So what hope is there? And then where's the accountability? Because we're not really, it feels like it's not we the people, it's we the nation of a bunch of middle managers that are running all these agencies that we never really wanted to. And it's unwieldy and you can't get rid of them.
Right.
It doesn't seem like there's a way to get.
I mean, you get elect a new Congress, but the staffers stay there
so,
throughout many administrations and the career bureaucrats are still there.
So walk me off the ledge here. Why shouldn't I now just jump?
Well, it's one of my first. That's one of my first bills, by the way. I would, if I'm elected, God willing, to Congress, I want to submit a bill that provides term limits for staffers. And I've seen this for years as an attorney. I've represented government officials, and in my judgment, it doesn't matter what president comes or goes. It's the staffers that think they run things, and they have targeted the presidential powers to appoint someone. And if they don't like them, they will bring them down. And those staffers can't be removed. So if we pass term limits on them, they're out. We've got to reform the civil service law. The whole reason it was passed back 100 years ago was because presidents were using the government wrongly. They would come into power 100 years ago, and all the workers were fired, and they would bring in all their family and friends. It was just total corruption, you can imagine. So they passed the Civil Service Reform Act where you can't fire anybody. Well, that didn't help either. It went the other way. So we got to fix that. So I would encourage Christians to not jump ship because of this. This is the greatest country, I believe, in the world for our voices, for our freedom, for our abilities. We have a constitution, and it's not a self-executing document. You can't just sit around and look at a constitution on the wall, no matter what country you're in. You have to have someone actually execute the Constitution, and that means use it or lose it. And if you are sitting down and not overwhelming the vote, whether or not you believe people are stealing your vote, if you're going to sit back and just give it to them anyway, you're basically lighting a match to your own Constitution, to your own family's heritage, to your own future, and that's never good no matter what country you're in. I mean, our founders didn't do that, and the people who came from England never did that. Look at the way the Mayflower got here. I mean, those dear souls risked life and limb, and half of their members died getting just to the soil and to the control, and that Mayflower Compact was something that they used to establish that government, that first government here. But they did not sit back and just idly let anything go or let things happen. They took charge of their own families. They took charge of their communities, and they established constitutional law, which was the historic rights that we had and that I believe that we have naturally. And it's sad to see that judges and lawyers, especially, and politicians don't believe in natural law. They believe in positive law, which I would love to have conversations with them, and I sometimes do. Say, you know, when you don't believe in natural law, guess what you're doing? You're undermining truth and justice.
Do we have time? Can you break that down? What do you mean by natural law versus positive law? Because I think some of the listeners may not.
So positive law is basically whatever the top dog says it is, and that's what most people believe nowadays. In other words, most judges will say, if you review the U.S. Senate confirmation notes, they will be asked questions like Ted Cruz grills them with questions, great questions. He's one of the best constitutionalists in America on these issues. And he will grill them, and you read their responses. He says, do you believe in the Constitution and the rights of man and men and women under God, under natural legal principles? In other words, that supersedes whatever Congress might pass. And their answers are always similar, not always, but most of these judges will say, no, I believe in the Constitution as interpreted by the Supreme Court. I will apply that only, and the statutes of Congress, period. Well, welcome to the Third Reich, because that's exactly what they did. So how are you going to differentiate this? Positive law can't answer this question. You have to get to the greater principles that are behind the rights of men and women, the rights of mankind. And this is, you know, Lockean theory, but it's more than that. It's a sense of our creator. It's the understanding of why we got the Magna Carta. It's why do we have these rights? They come from things that are in each of our hearts that
they
we know.
From God.
They come from God because God made us.
And that's going to be the last word for this week's show. Hopefully we can impose upon you to maybe join us for one more week's episode, or if you can do that, because I've got some other things I would like
to... Be an honor to.
...try to do some tying up some loose ends and that sort of thing, and pick up on some things that were said within the last 5-6 minutes of the show. And David's been saving his best questions for last, so maybe we'll get those in next week. Thank you so much. Dan Cox online at coxforcongress.org. You can find us online at householdoffaithinchrist.com. David, Daniel, I'm Troy. Dan, the two Dans here. Thanks so much. Till next week, 167 and a half hours from right now. God bless.
Past editions of this program are available in the audio vault at WFMD.com.